Hello, my name is Chip Lang, and you're listening to Totally EM. I have back with me again Katie Thompson, because as you may be noticing, as we're kind of covering a multi-part series here with pediatric abuse, and specifically the last time we talked a little bit about dogma of history and physical exam regarding abuse. And if you notice, we tried really hard to try and keep these sections separated, but it's so hard because this is naturally something that builds on top of itself. But one thing we just kept saying over and over again was we're going to talk a little more about forensic interviewing and sexual abuse. So naturally, that's what this topic, this portion of the podcast series is going to be about. And before we dive too far in this, I really want to plug Katie's IPV educators real quick and what she does. And it's phenomenal. Like that's the whole reason why I get to talk to someone as clever as she is and to learn more. So real quickly, Katie, if you don't mind, plug away, let us know what IPV educators is and what you do.
Well, thank you so much for the kind words. That's high praise. So like I said, I'm Katie Thompson. I'm IPV educators. And this company kind of came into being. The seed was first planted in PA school when I sat through, you know, a lecture, as I'm sure we all did, on sexual abuse, or sexual assault, actually, in particular. And then one on child abuse that lasted about 15 minutes. And I thought to myself, you know, I've got this background in forensic medicine and in forensic interviewing and things like that. And some of the things that they're teaching people are just not right. And some of them are just not covered well enough. And the more I moved about into healthcare, the more I realized that this was not just me that was feeling this way, that there are a lot of providers out there who wish that they had better background and more resources and more confidence in these areas. I'm a very flexible company. We do a lot of different things. I do lectures for PA schools. I lecture medical residents. I do interactive workshops. I'm almost always at AAPA lecture at the big conference lecturing or having some sort of seminar breakout session. I do curriculum building, curriculum consulting. I talk to hospitals. I talk to nurses. I help people design triage systems. The sky's really the limit. So if you've got your ideas, bring them to me. I'd love to hear them because honestly, like even if it doesn't go anywhere for the company, it really charges me up to know that there's people out there who are interested in this and who want to build better systems.
And we're going to talk about something that's directly in your wheelhouse today that you feel super comfortable with, just with your background and experience. And that is talking about sexual abuse, forensic interviewing. Now, I think what's important to talk about at the very beginning for those listening to this, so they don't just turn it off right away because they say, oh, I don't do this. We're not talking about the forensic interviewing like what you're seeing with the SANE, for example, the sexual assault nurse examiners, or what you're doing where you're taking, you know, literally in some cases hours of time devoted to the really detailed parts of the interview. This is more of like, I guess in some ways, kind of the screening or triage version of this, where we're just doing something rapid. This is not meant to start this long process, but more or less to get the information we need so we can make an accurate and preliminary decision as far as what's going on here. Is that fair?
Yes, absolutely. And to sort of clarify, or to, you know, jump off of that, to clarify that, I think that people often misinterpret the term forensic interviewing as something that only happens, you know, in a recorded room somewhere. But I interpret it a little bit more broadly. I think that forensic interviewing is basically a term that can be applied, especially to pediatric populations, when you're talking about like how to obtain clean answers from pediatric patients. And oftentimes we talk about with difficult to address topics like, you know, sexual abuse or physical abuse or other kind of like stressful or trauma-inducing topics for children. But I've found that after learning these sort of basic principles and being able to apply them to trauma-related pediatric scenarios, I translate them into my everyday practice. So I use these techniques of like how to build questions and how to build rapport with pediatric patients in my everyday practice. Every day in the emergency room or in the urgent care, I use them with pediatric patients.
Sounds great. So let's go ahead and get started on this. So what should we talk about first?
What should we talk about first? Well, since we're kind of on the subject of forensic interviewing, we can certainly start there, talk about how a forensic interview is set up or how to approach that with pediatric patients. And I have a few ideas for some resources for your listeners as well.
Absolutely.
Like I said, you know, I think complete forensic interview is often beyond what we would want healthcare providers to do. That would be not only time intensive, but also, you know, a level of skill that I think that most providers would feel that they don't necessarily want to or can develop or cultivate. And I think that that's perfectly acceptable. But there's a few things about forensic interviewing that I think are directly translatable and that can also help providers start a conversation with children about traumatic events in a way that provides a better base for the forensic interviewer that is going to come in later and question the child. And so one of those things is privacy. This is this can be a kind of a hard one to navigate, but I always talk to pediatric patients alone if I'm talking to them about traumatic events. And the reason for that, and this principle leads into my next point as well, is that children are adult pleasers. They're tiny little germ factories and they are adult pleasers. And they love nothing more than making adults happy. And they love nothing more than that than making their parents happy. And so if you have a parent in the room who is either verbally or non-verbally sort of cueing the child, that can kind of skew or warp your interview a little bit, or skew or warp like what you're able to talk about. And we've all been in those rooms with pediatric patients, even when it's not something that is trauma related. I can even remember like in the last week, probably at least count on one hand a number of pediatric patients that were being cued by their parents on some level. So that's kind of like principle number one. I would say that principle number two is like setting up yourself for success. So on the same subject, children love to please their parents, but when the parents aren't available, they'll settle for pleasing any adult. And whether we think about ourselves as overgrown children or not, we are technically classed as adults, especially to the little one. So,
love that.
We must be careful too about like how we're presenting ourselves, and that covers things like nonverbal communication, smiling, nodding, raising your eyebrows, looking excited, leaning forward. Those things can all be sort of like nonverbal cues for children that they are, quote, like on the right track, that they are headed down the path that you want them to head down. And similarly, crossing your arms, leaning back, looking disinterested, frowning, you know, other making noncommittal noises, those can all sort of lead children away from or discourage them from talking about something that you might want to hear more about. So you have to kind of find this sort of balance beam, this sort of middle ground. And that can be hard, but it is a system of practice. So the more you kind of become aware of yourself in a room, the more you're able to sort of build better practices around pediatric patients.
Okay, so kind of as a quick aside before we go into the next part of this, can you describe to me, you know, let's say I'm new with this. This is not something I normally do. And I want to ask this child, as well as maybe the parents, depending on who's there, but especially the child, I want to ask the child some simple questions because I'm trying to gauge what's going on here. And this may be good just for general interview purposes, not even just talking about related to abuse and neglect, but what kind of posture, what's a good posture? What's a good way to ask? I mean, obviously, I say obviously, but maybe a lot of people don't understand this, is that open questions are much better than closed-ended, especially ones that are very leading in nature. I mean, that's part of what a lawyer's job is to kind of ask leading questions, not asking leading questions. So what can we do to provide kind of a more neutral but still invitational? Like, we want the child to let them know that we care and that we want to know what's going on, but not to unintentionally invite them into a dialogue which could be inaccurate.
Right. So, I mean, what a great question. And I think there's a few things that sort of come to mind there. One of the things is that when you're preparing to ask children questions, and I think this stands for adults too, and this is how I've started to approach like my exam rooms. And I find that it does make a difference in the types of interviews that I have with patients of all ages. But the number one principle is kind of getting comfortable in the room. So instead of like coming in and sort of cramming yourself in a corner and towering over the patient, which can be easy to do in some rooms because, you know, they've got like 83 pieces of equipment in there and you don't fit in there with you and the family and the child and everyone else. So I always try to make myself a little space in the room where I can sit or kneel comfortably and get to the level of the patient. And so that's like principle number one. You never want to tower over children. They don't like it. It's intimidating. And it just isn't a good practice for having an honest conversation with anybody, much less a child. And then as far as like asking open-ended questions, I am personally a faithful follower of a man called Dr. Tom Lyons. And he is a psychologist and a lawyer, actually, which is a very interesting combination. He actually is a professor now at USC in Southern California. He spent most of his life talking about the forensic interviewing of children. So he's developed this sort of very friendly 10-step series of questions or ways to approach sort of a forensic interview with a child. And I think one of the best parts, one of the most golden parts of his like sort of 10 steps, and one that I think really translates well to any practice environment, but especially if you're going to be doing any sort of like trauma-related interviewing or trauma-informed care with children, is the first questions, basically the scene-setting questions. So I will happily provide a link to a PDF for those questions, like the notes. But if it's okay with you, I'd like to sort of talk through the first maybe like four of those sort of scene setting questions.
Yeah, absolutely. You got me intrigued. So I'd love to see, obviously, like you said, have the printout where people can review it. But I'd love to hear what the steps are.
Just to be totally clear about this, like we use this. I carry one of these pieces of paper into every single pediatric interview that I do still. And I've done hundreds at this point, but I still carry this with me because it helps me anchor my questions and helps me stay honest and make sure that I'm doing sort of like the right things for my pediatric patients. The first question that he recommends sort of asking pediatric patients is, it's a series of instructions. So the first four are basically like instructions, and they're kind of like mini scenarios that you get to sort of work with the patient. So the first one is called the I don't know instruction. So the way that I phrase it with children is I say, you know, if I ask you a question and you don't know the answer, then it's okay to say, I don't know. So if I ask you, Chip, what's my dog's name? What do you say?
I don't know.
Right. Because you don't even know if I have a dog, right? I could have a dog, I could have a cat, or I could have nothing at all. You don't know. But if I say, do you have a dog?
Farmer, I just want to say, I don't know. Yes.
Right. And then that also gives me an opportunity to kind of dialogue with your patient. So you can say, oh, really? You have a dog? What kind of dog is it? Is it brown? Is it black? Does it have black and white spots? And it gives them an opportunity to kind of tell you a little bit more in an open-ended fashion about like what about their pet. And then you say, okay, because you do know whether you have a dog or not. And the second instruction is the I don't understand question, or I don't understand instruction. So you say to the patient, if I ask you a question and you don't know what I mean or you don't understand what I'm saying, you can say, I don't know what you mean, or I don't understand, and I can ask it in a different way. So if I ask you, what is your ocular orientation? What do you say?
I don't know what you mean.
Right, because that's kind of a couple of really big words, right? But if I say, what's your eye color? What do you say?
It's brown.
Right. So see, I can ask things in a different way so that they're easier for you to understand. And then the third one is the you're wrong instruction. So sometimes I make a mistake or I say the wrong thing. And when I do, you can tell me that I'm wrong. So if I say, you are 12 years old, what do you say?
You're wrong.
Right. So how old are you? No, don't answer that question.
I was actually debating, like, oh, I guess I see where this is going.
But for kids, I mean, no, kids love to tell everybody about like their age and their hobbies and their pets and things like that. So that's a that's another opportunity to ask an open-ended question. So as you can see, as we move through these, you are not only getting an opportunity to teach children how to answer open-ended questions, but you're also setting up a fallible, unknowing interviewer who is just interested in hearing what the child has to say. It's non-confrontational. It is not specific to trauma yet, but it kind of like helps sort of set up a stage where the child is kind of the center of attention and the one that is the all-knowing.
That's awesome. I really just learned something hugely beneficial here. So I kind of knew, you know, with the open-ended questions, how you asked that, but having those three steps first, I feel like now I can take that away and use it a lot more beneficially than I ever would have before. So those are awesome points. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah. And then there's another step that I think is also sort of relevant, and we don't have to go into this at length, but when you read the PDFs, you can see it there. The last step before you start talking about anything trauma related is to practice some narratives. And this is where I think is just like, this is solid gold for talking to kids about anything. You start by practicing an open-ended narrative. So you say like, first, I'd like you to tell me about things that you like to do. And then they're like, okay, well, I like basketball. Oh, basketball, really? Tell me more about basketball. And that's all you ask. And so like, you know, as an example, in just like an ordinary clinic setting outside the context of like a forensic exam, like if a child comes in and they're just sitting on the bed glaring at you, which children often do, you know, you can say like, oh, Billy, like, you know, I heard from your mom that came to see the doctor for a reason, but first I want to ask you, you know, tell me everything that you like to do. And Billy's like, wait a second. Like, this isn't like an ordinary adult who's just kind of like torturing me and giving me a shot and then leaving. They actually like want to hear from me about what I want to do. And then they're like, okay, I'll give them a shot. We'll see. I like torturing my sister. Really? You like torturing your sister? Tell me everything about that.
Okay.
Like you get an opportunity just to sort of like to change the dynamic between you and pediatric patients. And I think then that translates really nicely into talking to them about trauma-related topics.
Those are all great tips, Katie. I really appreciate that. Anything else you want to add on that part, or should we move on to the next section?
I think those are kind of like my main takeaways. I could certainly, like I said, I could talk, you know, for hours about forensic interviewing, but I think that that's kind of like the major concepts that are like really high yield for like all practitioners, whether they're doing forensic, like full forensic interviews or not.
Okay, Katie, so now that we've talked to the interviewing side as far as like getting the history, I want to dive into a little more about the physical exam side. And I know a lot of people, including myself at times, are very hesitant to do certain parts of the physical exam because we don't want to screw it up for the next person or, you know, make this where we screw up the evidence collection or how the evidence can be used, so on and so forth, because we want to make sure we do the right thing, not only in our personal sense of doing the right thing, but also doing what's best for the patient and for the family and everyone else. So can you kind of guide us through a little bit about what are things that we should or maybe shouldn't do and how we actually can conduct the physical exam portion?
Dr. Adams actually has some information on this or some suggestions on this as well, which I can potentially link. I think I can link one or two articles of hers that will be helpful as far as like kind of some of these overall principles. But I think one of the biggest takeaways that I get a lot of questions on is I get a lot of questions from providers where they're like, I didn't know what to do. So I did a physical exam and I don't see anything. And it's like a case of like, you know, chronic or like long-term like child abuse. And they're like, I just didn't know whether I should do a physical exam or not. And I would say like, what Dr. Adams says is like 24 hours for children is kind of what I would consider to be the cutoff. Unless you can identify that like a child has been sexually abused within the last 24 hours, there's no utility in doing an acute exam unless they have like a vaginal or a you know, genital complaint of some kind, depending on the gender of the patient. So if you have a parent that drags their kid in and says, you know, they just told me that like my, you know, father's like best friend abused them a year ago, and I'm just like freaking out, then I think this is a good opportunity to kind of open a discussion with the parents and say, like, look, we're going to come around you. We're going to surround you with resources. We've got all these specialists that want to help you. But here, right now, unless they're saying that they have something wrong with their genital area, there's really no reason for me to subject them to an exam.
That's very helpful, because I've run into this scenario multiple times, and I'm sure other people have too. And so we end up calling whoever we're going to refer them to, and they basically say the same thing, right? But to have that we can tell the parents up front in the beginning versus maybe alluding to something that doesn't actually happen can obviously leave some people upset. Less than 24 hours, pretty definite we're going to do something, or if there is something actively going on with the genitalia. Perfect. Thank you.
Exactly. Yeah. And then related to that, I think I probably have this discussion with parents and family members more than most providers do. At least I hope so, because I hope that not very many people are subjected to this. But the hymen discussion is always a popular one. Oh, well, can you tell me, is she still a virgin? You know, like, is her hymen ruptured? And I think that this is another opportunity for clinician education of family members to say, like, you know, well, I mean, there's some very good literature out there that says that the state of the hymen is not really related to anything that the child is complaining of or said happened. And so it's, you know, it's really important for you to realize that anything that I see or anything that a forensic examiner sees is not necessarily going to be indicative of any sort of like contact.
That's a huge one. I have fortunately only had to do this maybe a couple of times, but to get asked that question along with some of the other kind of related questions to it can be so challenging, because there's the dogma that the public knows, or at least feels like they know about it. And then what you have to explain from a scientific side can be very challenging to meet the two without either making you sound like a quack or making them sound like idiots for asking. And I think it's a very delicate conversation to have.
Exactly. And then I think that the other main thing that I would want people to take away from this recording session is that no one expects you to be like a forensic expert just from doing like one or two of these exams. No one expects you to be able to identify the subtlest of findings. If they have what we want you to do, what the forensic community wants you to do, is to treat patients medically, which is what you're very good at. So if they have a complaint and you do an exam, or you need to do an exam, you are our first priority. It's just the same way that like no one is going to come to a family justice center or to a sexual assault center, you know, hemorrhaging from an open wound, right? Like we would never send someone like from an ER directly to a forensic exam center while they're still medically unstable. It's the same principle. All we want you to do is to treat the patient medically. And that includes doing whatever you need to do to do that. So I think that is one of the major takeaways for listeners that can help them kind of gain some confidence here, is that if you screw something up, or if you like erase some evidence or something like that, that's just the way it is. And that is the way that it has to be in order to properly medically treat the patient. And so we want you to properly medically treat the patient. And then the other thing is that I think it can be helpful for providers to realize is that, and we all know this somewhere, you know, we learned it somewhere in school, but to realize that vaginal or genital injuries heal immensely fast, 24 hours, 48 hours, and there may be absolutely no sign of a genital injury. And so that's one of the reasons why there's really no utility in doing an exam after 24 hours. And it's also the reason why those interviews and exams are often done like non-acutely. So they don't need to be called necessarily at like 2 a.m. The child's not going to be dragged into the Family Justice Center at 2 a.m. to complete a complete, you know, forensic interview and an exam for something that happened 6 months ago.
Okay, Katie, in such a short time, you've already provided us with a ton of information. And like you said, forensic interviewing, we can talk about this for hours, but I think hitting the highlights right now, having those supplemental resources are going to be immensely beneficial for whoever's listening to this and wants to learn more. And I feel like we're going to have a lot more that we can talk about in the future. So especially for those people who are listening, if you want to learn more, or if you have specific questions, please reach out so we can address those in future podcasts. And I'm sure Katie would be always happy to answer questions. But one last thing, because I think it's something that's really important if we're going to talk about this, and one that could be often you know, not thought of until kind of last minute when you realize, oh, crap, like, what do I do in this case is patient positioning.
Yes. So I think this is another one that gets, like, honestly neglected in schooling. Like, we don't really talk about, like, how to address, like, pediatric positioning, like, for a genital exam, really, in school. I don't remember covering that at length. That's one of the things that I kind of wanted to talk about a little bit. I think that there are a few kind of, like, general principles or general tips that can help people. One of which is, like, one of my favorite books of all time, and that's sort of, it's a photo atlas of pediatric genitalia, which sounds kind of like overwhelming at first, but it kind of gives you an impression or an understanding of, like, how many normal variations there are in, like, say, like, hymen anatomy, and also just familiarizing yourself with the differences between, you know, post puberty genitalia and prepubescent genitalia and things like that. I think that can be really helpful in, like, raising the confidence. I will post the name in the comments. I think it is called the medical approach to child sexual abuse. But I'd have to go downstairs and look at my bookshelf to remember fully. So I will post the name and author in the comments. And then the other thing about positioning, so there's a couple of ways, especially with young boys are a little bit easier because, you know, it's a little less complex as far as, like, what you need to expose. But young girls can be quite challenging exams. And so the principles that I would like to kind of address is, like, number one, how to apply traction so that you can clearly see the, like, labia minora and the vestibule and the vaginal opening and the hymen tissue. Number two, how to position the child in a position of comfort and, you know, one that provides you the best opportunity to do the exam. And number three, just some kind of, like, overall tips and tricks for getting the best exam out of kids. So as far as, like, number one goes, which is the how to apply traction, I think that providers who aren't trained on this tend to be a little hesitant here. And I can understand that. I was too in the beginning. So when I first learned how to do pediatric exams for forensic medicine, I was shadowing, you know, a more experienced provider. And she goes, oh yeah, like, for kids, like, all you do is you just, you know, really, like, lock down on those labia majora and give them a good outward motion, a good, like, outward tug, like, towards the legs. And I was like, oh dear God, that sounds terrible. But the important thing to realize is that in pediatric, in prepubescent girls, that tissue is really not very sensitive at all. So you can really pinch the labia majora in order to provide some traction to expose the labia minora and the hymen tissue.
That's interesting because I, by that description, thought that would have been horribly painful, but.
And I think that that's a common principle. And so I think that it's very common to want to approach that part of the exam very gingerly because in post-pubescent women, that tissue is more sensitized and that is an effect of estrogen along with some other stuff that I could do an entire hour lecture on. But principle number two is kind of like patient positioning or like how to position a patient in a position of comfort. And this is where you get a chance to sort of read the room and figure out what kind of child you have. Because some children are more durable than others. And we know this from experience with just normal pediatric populations. Some just melt, dissolve into a pile of tears the second you walk into the room. And some are like, oh, hey, what's up? How's it going? You want to give me a shot? Sure, no problem. You know, that kind of thing. So, and then there's, of course, everywhere in between. And the same applies for, like, you know, a genital exam. So some children may be very hesitant, very clingy. Some may be perfectly willing to lie on an exam table. But I think the two kind of, like, sub principles here are just sort of read your room and figure out what kind of child you have and position them accordingly. And one of the techniques that I use for the clingier children or the ones who seem like they're really just not going to be able to cooperate fully with the exam is I sit them on a parent's lap. So especially for young girls, for vaginal exams, what you can do is you can have them sit with their legs dangling forward, same direction as the parent's legs. So their chest is outward. Have them sit on the parent's lap. And the parent can kind of rock them back a little bit and lift up their legs and basically form kind of like like stirrups for the child's legs. And so they sort of hold the child's legs outward in a comfortable position. That, and then the child is able to sort of lean back or relax back against the parent's chest. And the parent can be like right there, kind of like next to the child's ears and sort of comforting them and other things like that, while you basically are at eye level in front of the pediatric patient doing the exam. So that's one of the techniques that I use for, especially for my more hesitant patients. Obviously, that there is a point where they will get too big for that, where they, you know, they will be too large to do that. And then you would have to talk about like stirrups and things like that. But I find stirrups to be pretty intimidating for children.
Yeah, I think the stirrups, it's good in theory until you actually try and do something. And like you said, it's just very intimidating. So I think it's something that in most of the cases, even when we do our regular pelvic exams, we're not even usually using them that often, mainly because we only have one bed that's even capable of doing it at my main shop.
Don't even get me started about like my one woman marching band that like every room should be able to do a pelvic exam. Like, don't even get me started. We'll be here all day.
Well, in that case, just so we don't dive off into anything else, do you have any other things you wanted to cover specifically? I know this is a huge topic, but I just didn't know if there was anything else we wanted to cover.
I think that a good start at least. And like you said, I welcome questions. So, or concerns or even what if situations, like I love hearing from people who have experienced things that they don't feel like I covered. I love this in my AAPA lectures too. I think it's really important that we start to open an honest dialogue amongst providers and specialists about how this experience is sort of globally and throughout the nation and what we can do to improve it on all different levels. Like what works in an urban center might not work in a rural center. And so I think it's really important for me to hear those things. And so I absolutely, like, no matter how you reach out, whether it's through like Total EM or whether it's through my website or, you know, on social media, whatever it is, I welcome your input and your questions.
Well, thank you so much, Katie. So just before we go, can you give us the tagline, please?
Until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.